I'd like to welcome to Planet Waves FM, making his first appearance with us, Daniel Gemario, author of the Shamanic Astrology Handbook. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for inviting me. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, a privilege. And I'm looking forward to a meaningful conversation about astrology. And maybe I'm in the right place. What I'd like to speak with you about is what Pluto in Aquarius might be about. Now, no one's ever lived through this. No one ever knew. No one ever did. Last time it happened was the 18th century.
Right.
And we've just come through Saturn in Aquarius, and I'm wondering if there's some connection there. So could you please share some of your thoughts on the past, now wrapping up 3 years of Saturn in Aquarius?
Sure. It's actually been a very major theme of my school's focus and what I've been talking about actually since 2017, when I had created a summit called Preparing for 2020, you know, looking at the different aspects that were happening in 2020. To me, Saturn, which is the previously had a more well-known connection with Aquarius. In more recent times, most astrologers think Aquarius is all about Uranus. Mm-hmm. But there is a Saturn connection to Aquarius, and I think Saturn's function is to provide structure and reality principle and objectivity, but it's not, how do we put this, it's not, I believe Saturn goes back a lot much further than the last 2,000 years. So in the last 2,000 years, it's become overlaid or hijacked by a very strong patriarchal emphasis. So therefore, it's about guilt and judgment and boundaries in the negative sense and deficiency and things like that. So what Saturn is really, in more recent times, been trying to do is to prevent, in my opinion, the idealism and the eccentricity and the individuality that is implied by Aquarius. It's almost as if Aquarius has been fully hijacked with the Saturn transit through it. And so there was a lot of astrologers, even many people in my own field, who wrote all this stuff back in 2019. Oh, about how magnificent Saturn in Aquarius was going to be, that it was going to be the establishment of, once again, you know, here we go again, the Aquarian Age, when which, of course, has been something people have talked about since the late 1800s. You know, oh, it's the Aquarian Age now. No, it's the Aquarian Age now. You know, again, here we go again. Mm-hmm. 1962, I remember that really quite well, you know, with the seven planets in Aquarius. At any rate, they were very optimistic and idealistic about it, and I think they completely left out and were not wanting to look at the, quote, shadow side of Saturn in Aquarius. And I think you've, in previous presentations you've made, or have been quite articulate about this, where it's really about the establishment of a collectivity, of a, like a Borg consciousness, or the establishment of a mob rule, or the shadow side of so-called democracy, you know, which, of course, as you know, our founding fathers warned against, that is to say, democracy. They also warned against a two-party system also. It's more like the Gemini issue with Mars and Gemini in the U.S. chart. But anyway, so I did many presentations about beware of Saturn in Aquarius from the perspective of it creating this collective greater good BS, which is a philosophy major back in the late 60s. God, it was all debunked. That whole utilitarian greater good thing was no philosopher worth his salt would ever go there, because it had been thoroughly debunked. And, you know, here we are again.
How would you sum the greater good philosophy up?
That individuals don't matter, that actually you look at the statistics of what will produce the greater good, and, of course, the greater good is defined by certain things that may not actually be what's most important to being a human being. You know, so they're basically saying, well, the greater good would be would be that our statistics show that if you have a certain number of people get injected, then the greater number of people are safe, or something like that. You know, which is it takes away from sovereignty and individuality. Which to me, I always thought, at least when I was learning astrology in the late 60s, early 70s, that Aquarius, of all the different astrological archetypes, was really strongly into sovereignty and autonomy. I knew there was always the dark side of it, which was mob rule. You know, the revolution eating its children, you know, that kind of thing. You know, the French Revolution and so on. But the swing into collectivism and mob rule and democracy based on the worst excesses of a media-driven culture is resulted in the situation we find ourselves in.
Yes, and somewhere people have an idealism that's largely untapped, and then it gets exploited.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy for people who aren't, don't have some connection to their I'll just go ahead and say it, to their soul, to what it is to be a genuine human being, an authentic human being with compassion and empathy and a sort of kind of a mammalian heart, you know, that can include loving others, really, you know, above, you know, as much as yourself or more than yourself. If they don't have that connection, then they can just be brainwashed by these more intellectual concepts of, technology will save us, or the scientist elite, you know, technocratic elite, they know what's best for the rest of us, you know. So it's really particularly sad for the countries like the U.S. or the crown colonies and so on, who are like orphan cultures that have never really had very many elders. And so they're kind of a puer culture, looking for daddy or looking for someone to lead them rather than taking responsibility for their own life.
Mm-hmm. That is an interesting observation. Yep.
That was the insights that came from individuals like Martine Prechtel, but also from Stephen Jenkinson in Canada, of the Orphan Wisdom School. His whole thing is about how when the Europeans first came over here to the U.S. or to Canada and so on, they didn't bring their elders. They were trying to get away from the elders that they rejected. So the elders were already here, the Native American elders that actually, in a way, sourced the ideals of the Enlightenment, but it was, of course, hijacked in different ways by Europeans. But so it's an orphan culture, really, with very little roots to their indigenous soul.
Yeah, almost like runaways.
Yes. That's what's intimated here, indeed.
And Robert Bly used the term the sibling society, which I always loved. A society without adults, where there's no adult in the room.
Right.
See, yep. I have the Saturn principle quite strongly in my chart. I have Saturn in Aquarius, and I work that Saturn. And so I have this expectation that there will be an adult in the room. And I was eagerly awaiting that as this COVID thing broke open. But one by one, the leaders were just falling. The leaders of holistic movements, the health food stores, the local healing practitioners, it was they were basically getting mowed down by this concept,
as well as
death
like
threat.
One of the things, many of my students and clients are Waldorf people, you know, Steiner education.
Sure.
And it's just been breaking my heart how that whole organizational structure has caved in. In fact, almost every one of the spiritual schools have been associated caved in, you know, to just going along with the agenda. And if there's anything that would have recognized the importance of the questioning an injection strategy, it would be the Steiner people. But
yeah,
no,
you have
You have to go to an independent Steiner school. There's only two of them in Australia and New Zealand, you know. And they're the only ones holding out against the rules of the hierarchy.
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, I went to visit my own, one of my very most important teachers who, well, he started as a therapist, but we developed a much more intricate study mm-hmm. relationship. And he founded a field of therapy called holistic therapy. And in mm-hmm. one day in May, I went to visit him and he answered the door wearing a mask.
Yeah.
I'm like,
it's incredible.
Joe, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
What, are you kidding me? And his wife was very upset. And she's like, well, you should treat him with respect. And I said, you better believe I am. What are you doing?
Yeah.
What do you think respect is? I'm going to suck his dick.
Oh, God.
So,
I know.
I didn't say that part, but I stood my ground, and I didn't talk to them for more than 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's it. I'm not getting into a drama with this guy. I'm not turning it into a daddy right. drama. You can want to wear a mask. Go wear a mask. Go get the shot. He did. Mm-hmm. So, like, okay, well, I'm not going to cash in, you know, 30 years of highly productive work just because he went crazy at the end of his life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you've got to watch the teachers who go crazy at the end of their life. Anyway, so this...
I can name a whole bunch from my side. The same thing has happened. I mean, the grieving about it and the shock about it has just been immense. But I'm not interested in trying to convince them anymore. And, of course, some of them have come around. Some of them have seen the light, but you're not going to ever hear one thing from them saying that, sorry, we were wrong. Yeah. No, we just now have better science or something, you know.
Yeah, it would be nice healing in the nice in the sense of healing if there was a little bit of that. But I recognize that that's not a grounded expectation. So no point. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
You know, and my role as the student is to carry on.
By the way, you spoke about how you are strongly. You have a strong Saturn signature. Well, so do I. I mean, Capricorn Moon, Saturn conjunct Venus and Virgo. In fact, I one time, just for the fun of it, had a session from a person who billed themselves as doing medieval astrology, right? And they're very rule-oriented, you know, like this is positive, this is negative, you know, and so on. And he looked at it and said, well, you know, you, according to these rules for medieval astrology, have the maximum allotment of Saturn that anyone could possibly have. But they never would have done a reading for you because of the fact they would have assumed you'd be dead before age 5.
I was going to say exactly precisely that. I was going to say that you talked to the person and they predicted you would be dead by 1960.
Exactly.
But lo and behold, you were alive. You know, 40, 50 years later. What a crazy coincidence.
And a lot of the work I do is on the revisioning of Saturn, removing the hijack, which I call of Saturn, and looking at it in a pre-patriarchal perspective, taking it back further. I always am fond of telling the story. You may know this. Of when Galileo first, saw the rings around Saturn in his, primitive telescope. You know what he wrote in his diary? Have you heard this story?
No, I have not.
he wrote in his diary after seeing the rings, "Oh my God, the old man has a beard." Which is how the predominant consciousness of the time colors how you see.
Sure. Another mm-hmm. astronomer, leading the way. I mean, Galileo, just as an aside, I thought was particularly interesting because he did note the movement of Neptune in his notebook. I have it, and I've published it, and he did, and we all know he did. And fixed stars don't move measurably in 1 month.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't have the ability to step outside of his reality frame and say, oh, there's another one out there.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting? But the story of Neptune is it got discovered and then lost and then rediscovered and then lost and then rediscovered, and finally someone like pinned it. But it took from the early 1400s to the late mid 1800s. Crazy. Okay, so Saturn. I think that Saturn, I agree with Isabel Hickey, that Saturn is a feminine principle.
Yes, me too. Me too. I feel the same way about Pluto when we get to Pluto.
Okay, that's interesting. So, you know, I think of Saturn as being about proper ego formation and being able to be on time and handle basic adult responsibilities. I don't have a very complicated view of Saturn. I think it's just it's the most practical utility that we have that, you know, helps us like stand up, make a cup of coffee, that kind of thing.
Well, the way I like to explain it to my students is that prior to the injection of the superego, as described by original sin beliefs and guilt and shame and all the rest of it, that also that the way I try to explain Saturn is say, well, it's a 3D operating manual, you know, so don't jump off a cliff. Don't stick your finger in a fire. And that's what it is. And it also then has that remarkable principle of being symbolic of different stages of maturation, you know, so you can tell from it, like when puberty happens, when menopause happens, and it's different for human beings. It works a particular way. You can also use it for animals. You know, you can come up with different frameworks for different species based upon the Saturn being the great chronocrator, you know, the thing that establishes the boundaries in the middle world for time and, you know, and for phases of life, you know. So that's to me that's a great principle. We need that, right?
Yes.
But not the shame and guilt and deficiency and judgment and Father God kind of crap, which I believe was the what I call the hijack of it.
Yeah, and wet blankets. And part of this is about the divorce of Saturn from Aquarius.
Yeah.
Because they, you know, Raphael, I believe the third publisher of the Ephemeris, basically arbitrarily attributed Uranus to Aquarius as the ruler.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there's some associations, but not that much.
Well, the using both actually helps explain, you know, what's going on with it. You know, so there is the sky god, transcendent, global overview, the eye behind the eye, the witness consciousness, the vipassana, the insight thing that can come from the ancient sky god, you know, kind of the encompassing overview. But then the Saturn part of it is real. I always like saying this. People have this false notion of Aquarius. It's every bit as, quote, fixed as Leo, and they both have an equal sense of entitlement. You know, I see a lot of these individuals with strong Aquarius thinking they're exempt from what regular human beings have to go through. You know, that sense of entitlement and, you know, like I'm exempt. Particularly, I find that with Aquarius moon people. You know, it's like, gee, have to have feelings and emotions and to actually be vulnerable and things like that.
Right. Well, I hopefully escape that part as a fairly strong Aquarius moon. Also, I mean,
oh yeah,
I know the issues. I mean, I know the issues. I know the issues. I mean, everything's got its shadow side, and it's the thing with Aquarius is, and I'm warning about this. I mean, I did the Aquarius inner space reading today, and I basically began by saying, all right, look, we were all bullshitted about Aquarius in the age of Aquarius. Let me show you.
Right.
This is how bad it is. When the moon is in the seventh house and Jupiter aligns with Mars is when the age of Aquarius begins. Except that the moon's been in the seventh house for 2 hours a day for 4 billion years. And Jupiter aligns with Mars by conjunction every 2 years, by opposition every 2 years, by square every year, and then by bazillion other aspects. So Jupiter's pretty much always aligned with Mars. So that's a completely meaningless statement. And the rest of what we think about Aquarius follows suit. So my presentation on Aquarius is pattern formation and crystallization, including electrical and social patterns.
Right.
And in addition to being the sign of groups and of weirdos, it's the sign of the tension between the individual and the group, the confrontation of the individual and the group. And there's a lot of ways that can go. You can get smashed. You can stand up and fight. You can join them rather than beat them, and many other qualities.
There's another thing I could weave into it, if you don't mind.
Please.
Much of the research of our school and what has been a big issue for me in my research is the way in which the constellational myths connect with what happened with how the sign understanding took place. And the thing about Aquarius originally, the constellation, is the water bearer.
Mm-hmm.
And so that to me, there's an element of water that unfortunately got missing when the Hellenistic culture designed the sign. It was ended up being named after the same arrangement of stars. And I think this does relate to our current situation now, where on one hand, most everybody is thinking that Aquarius would be associated with technology, with digital, with while in fact, human beings, more than anything, are water, or beings that are water. And the thing about water crystals is that they are capable of evolving, while silicon crystals cannot. They can only be programmed. And so the injection of this sort of water element that Jung very much knew about in his book on the Aeon, which was moving the equinox point through the stars of Aquarius, I think a lot of got lost in translation when the Greeks created the sign that was inspired by the constellational group. Mm-hmm. The same thing actually happened with Gemini, where the original Gemini constellation was a boy and a girl that came out of primeval chaos. So it's the first principle of gender, really, male and female coming out of primeval chaos. And then that story got hijacked by, the Greeks in different ways and also by the whole story of the around the world about the warring brothers. That was a much later story that was tacked on to what the original constellational myth was of the twins coming out of primeval chaos.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that the water aspect of the water bearer, this is why I tell people, what is this Age of Aquarius stuff? It's actually the spring equinox, whenever you say it's going to be, moving into a constellation. It's nothing to do with the sign of Aquarius.
Mm-hmm.
Or very little to do with it anyway.
Yeah, though the word is evocative. And my take on it is that since the electrical age, we are in the Age of Aquarius because of its tribalizing function, the tribalizing quality of electricity, the de-individuation of electricity, is, I think, I'm a student of the McLuhan family.
I got your emails about that, and that was extremely influential to me. I think I sent you the thing I wrote for my school about McLuhan.
Mm-hmm. So that when we get into this tribalizing and de-individuating quality.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't know if you knew David Rell, a mega Aquarian who ran the Astrology Center of America. You must have known him. You wrote a book. Anyway, he said, the Age of Aquarius began when art could be ugly.
Mm.
When art stopped being beautiful, we were in the Age of Aquarius.
I don't know how much you want to go in the direction of so-called beginning of the Age of Aquarius. But I'll just tell one quick story. I used to travel around teaching, and I would go to Nevada City a lot, California, back when it was a really progressive, in the old sense of that word, place. And I was giving talks, and I was this woman who was probably in her 70s, her 80s, said, "I would like to take you into my library." And she took me back into her library, old books, and she showed me all these different volumes from the 20s about the Age of Aquarius.
Uh-huh.
where they basically were saying, "Oh yes, we're at the dawn of the Age of Aquarius," and that was in the 1920s, and that really kind of expanded my awareness on it, because I was caught up in the debunking of the late 60s Age of Aquarius, but still looking at it as a phenomena that trying to figure out when what that date would be, and I wrote several research papers on that showing the 50, 60 possible dates. I think I have the answer to it, but we don't have to go down that that route. I'm just saying that this has been around for a long time, and it connects to what you're saying about, when art changed, which it did quite a bit with, postmodernity and with, the abstract art and getting away from, I guess you could say, the romanticism approach to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the need for art to not be realist, because photography took that job.
Yeah. And now the people who are incredible photographers, look what's happened to them with digital. I mean, I'm more of an analog guy, although I'm not completely a Luddite. I'm more of a neo-Luddite who believes that the technology should be a choice. But if you're going to use it, and particularly if you're an astrologer, you should have an apprenticeship with nature first, and then you can use your apps.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. So, I mean, I couldn't help but notice the fact that some people in Davos, Switzerland, ordered 4.4 billion people under house arrest within about 5 minutes of Saturn entering Aquarius.
Right. Yeah, me too.
It's not what I had in mind, but it's what happened.
Yeah, and that was, to me, the first sign that what I've been warning people about the shadow of Aquarius had come true. And this was actually warned against. One of the more prescient and amazing books was a book called Aquarius, written by William Braden in 1970, where he clearly showed the two paths that were operating. He said there's two possible choices. One, the one we've gone down into that we're all experiencing now, and the other was the kind of a part of that late 60s dream, which is to have a kind of matriarchal version of human beings together, kind of human 1.0, but from a more matriarchal, non-patriarchal perspective. When I say matriarchal, I don't mean ruled by women. I'm talking about a more gylanic or more cooperative and partnership culture between men and women. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of that whole indigenous kind of thing of connecting to that approach, which could have been part of what the Age of Aquarius could go down, that route. But it didn't, of course. It mm-hmm. went into the digital and technocratic approach. He warned about it in 1970.
So maybe you could help counsel me on why I am so worried about Pluto and Aquarius.
Well, sure. Okay. Let's talk about that. So,
Thank you. I need to open up about this, Daniel, and I'm choosing to do it with you.
So, first of all, if I think you wanted me to share, at least from the perspective of the work I'm involved in, how I would perceive Pluto. Right.
Definitely.
So I brought up the fact that I believe that also Pluto, as a symbol, was also hijacked. That to me, Pluto is more of a feminine energy, but it's not like some love and light feminine. It's the dark goddesses. It's even including Arishkigal, including Kali, certain aspects of Shakti, certain aspects of Durga. It's actually the version of the feminine that is involved with composting, when something needs to be composted, it does that job. Originally, also as the goddesses or the symbols or the deities of the underworld, it was not as today we just think of shadow or depth psychology, but rather way back, let's say, it had to do with the chthonic realm. It had to do with the lava tubes running under the earth, the powerful ocean currents that were there below the ocean. And then, of course, Zeus allocates the world to the brothers, But that's to me, that isn't really not what the principle of Pluto is. Pluto is instinctual. It's not a human realm. One of the main symbols that I always use in one of the conversations I always use in our school: what is the essential difference between Saturn and Pluto? Well, the biggest difference is this: with Saturn, you can figure it out, even if you don't like the results. You know, you can use objective awareness. Well, you've had this your relationship has been with the same woman seven times in a row, right? So maybe it didn't work the seventh time. Maybe you should change the game. I mean, you can figure that out. But with Pluto, it's like when it's time for something to be composted, for something to be transformed through composting, through that surrender into the death place. Well, then that's what it does, and it's not based upon logic or reason. So it's a cycle out of time. It's a cycle that's not within the boundaries of Saturn's realm. You know, which would have to do with, you know, time and linear and objectivity. So it's conditions beyond one's control that induces surrender. It's also an antidote to hubris, which is another thing that happens with Saturn. The Luciferian aspect of Saturn, which is we can all become gods, you know, but not, that's of course Saturn and Aquarius like that. But with Pluto, every sign Pluto is in is going to show what needs to be composted, or where the quote, bringing up the modern time periods, where's the shadow of that particular astrological energy? What has been hidden? What are the secrets of it? Since it's not a human realm, you know, it's more like, what is Gaia going to do? You know, what is the sun going to do? What is nature going to do? I mean, that's much more about like Pluto. And so if it notices that Aquarius is becoming too digital, shall we say, or too non-human, then Pluto is going to break it down. And it, to me, that leads to something that we can talk about in a different way, something we discussed before coming on the air now, which is about the result of that breaking down is people have to face grieving, and maybe what have you loved? Have you loved anything? And then loving then can produce the breakdown, which then is grieving. And out of grief becomes beauty, and becomes flowering, and becomes the richness of new life. Out of grief, out of the tears of grief. So I think Pluto is involved with doing that to Aquarius. It's to turn it into something that's capable of grieving, something that's capable of feeling the depth of emotion, which Aquarius does its best to get out of. You know, as objectivity is all, or you know, the witness consciousness is all, the cosmic overview is all. Well, not according to Pluto. So if you want to go higher and further out, you could go down and in. You know, so that's I think what Pluto is doing to Aquarius. Anyway,
so let's consider Capricorn though. I mean, you know, one way to look at Pluto and Capricorn is it did have that kind of effect on the corporate power structure, but as we leave the Pluto in Capricorn era, it only seems that these corporate, mighty corporate concepts have only become bigger. I mean, we now live in the age of like one company, Big Tech Incorporated.
Right.
So it seems to have flipped. I mean, it would have been nice to have seen like a return to much more grassroots commerce under Pluto and Capricorn. But it doesn't
but it
seem
was also
to have...
Saturn, but it was also Saturn Capricorn, and as I would look at it from a larger perspective, is that since the hijack of Saturn, that it ends up being inherently, you know, quote, conservative in the original sense of the word, so it's not going to look at drastic change in a good way. It's going to hold on to what it believes that what has worked up to that particular time period. So it's like doubling down, you know. It's like raising the ante. It's like let's do this even more, and that feeds into then the collectivism dream of Aquarius, you know, the Borg. You know, so those two work together from that shadow perspective, I would think. But Pluto, to me, is what breaks it down. What causes it to ultimately fail. So. I mean, that's why I end up being optimistic on one level, and that with at the same time being you know, realistic about what's taking place. It's not this sort of naive light washing of you know, let's just all go to 5D immediately. You know,
it's
just
light washing.
Yes.
I've been looking for a word for it for all these years.
Well, we use spiritual bypassing and we use light polarization, but yeah, I came upon light washing. I love it too.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, it would maybe in another conversation or at the end of this one, we can talk about like what happened to all those 2012 people.
I know what happened. I mean, one of them was a really good friend of mine, and he caught the shadow recoil of it and died within a year after it. And that was John Major Jenkins. He was a good guy. He did some incredible, really great research. And unfortunately, he was put into the camp of apocalyptic and end of the world kind of stuff, which was absolutely not what his research was. But he was put in that camp, and unfortunately, he felt he had to defend every 15-page email that he was blasted by, and it ended up killing him. He wasn't able to detach from the recoil. Another kind of victim of that was Daniel Pinchback, I'm afraid. That's a whole other story. But yep. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, and so too, Jose Arguelles didn't make it. And anyway, so. But all the 2012 stuff seemed to come down in 2020.
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay, so we kind of... Yes, oh no, please continue.
Oh no, no, so I was just going to say that I know that when you wanted to have this conversation with me before, when we first talked about this, you were saying to me that let's talk about what's positive or what's hopeful about Pluto and Aquarius.
Let's lightwash it.
Well, but no, it's interesting, the irony, because it's the thing that is promising or hopeful about it is that it will compost these things which we've talked about concerned about, you know, which is the what happened with Saturn and Capricorn, which is just to make the corporate the Borg through you know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. So it just becomes worse. But then also Saturn in Aquarius, as far as I can see, wants to just double down, you know. So then we have the, you know, global passports, we have the digital money, you know, all of it. It's just like, let's take it even further. But Pluto says, wait a minute. This
okay.
is not what got...
Yep. I'm following.
And then this leads up to other things, you know. I mean, it's difficult to not include the U.S. chart in all of this, but the fact is, a couple of years from now, for the first time, that there's a fourth turning that where Uranus is not involved in it, but it's the Uranian return is a few years after, you know. So that the Uranian return to the U.S. chart is, you know, after the ending of the. All these other things, you know, the Neptune opposition, the Pluto return, the Chiron return, and the fourth turning material. Mm-hmm. So it's there's things on the horizon that are quite a bit, we can say, the results of Pluto's work on grinding down and composting the versions of the Borg that are not useful to human 1.0.
But we're not there yet. I mean, we are in the age where digital people and digital things seem to have all the power, and it's a transformation of consciousness.
Right.
I mean, my shocking COVID moment. I think you mentioned you had read this piece was when I started analyzing the behavior of people at Woodstock 69 during the so-called Hong Kong flu. And the behavior of people in 2020 during the so-called COVID pandemic,
right?
And the kids at Woodstock were just basically sitting around in a mud puddle, having every kind of largely heterosexual sex and taking every drug and sharing joints and being rained on for 3 days, just hanging out in a field, and they were not afraid.
Right. Yeah, that's my gen.
And good for you guys. I appreciate it. I knew some cool baby boomers. I mean, they're not all Pluto and Leo narcissists.
Well, actually, I have to tell you this thing. Sorry to jump in.
No, please.
It's that in my generation, what really was tremendous, other than the Beatles coming in 64, the thing that was even more impactful, 1959 to 1963, was the television show Twilight Zone, which was just so incredibly stunning, mind-opening to my generation. And it is said that the bifurcation even was seen there, that if you saw a particular show, you would end up becoming, quote, liberal, back when that was a different thing. And if you didn't see that show, you'd end up becoming conservative. That you either had your mind opened by those shows or you didn't, and if you didn't have your mind opened by those shows, then you ended up becoming, a Nixon supporter, or
Square.
the end up becoming the counterattack against the revolutionary breakthroughs that were happening in the 60s.
So the show was imbued with a kind of magical power.
It certainly was. And Rod Serling was very Aquarian in the best sense of that expression. And he was blacklisted because he was considered to be communist back in the during that time period. And so he was able to get his concepts out through science fiction.
Yeah, I see. So he really did have something to do with the concept of the program. He wasn't just its actor and narrator.
Oh my God, yes, he wrote about half of them, and he had the best writers that actually, are you familiar with the movie 7 Days in May, which has all the incredible stuff in it? It was actually Kennedy allowed the filming in the White House, and it, kind of because he knew what was coming. And the movie 7 Days in May is pretty much every clue you could ever imagine about the killing of Kennedy is in that movie. And that the screenplay of that movie was Rod Serling.
Okay, I will watch this. Okay, so there, I think that we're under the thrall of this digital shadow in-group, out-group, locked-in patterns version of Aquarius. And Pluto, what you're saying here is Pluto could kind of break down those fibers.
But I don't want to go so far to say that Pluto is working for humans. I mean, because there can be this tendency to believe that even the whole Atlantean story, it's like, well, that's because of humans got became bad, so it's all about humans, what humans do or don't do. I mean, I think that the role of human beings in all of this is important, but still we take ourselves too seriously. I mean, some of these changes that happen on planet Earth are just part of natural cycles that have nothing to do with what humans do or don't do. So when I'm saying Pluto's not working for humans, I mean, it's more like it's the Earth herself. It's the sun. It's the
It's a
natural
cosmic
world.
force. You're saying it's a cosmic force. I mean, Crowley, who I really learned about Pluto from, thank God, before I, encountered, for example, Jeff Green, called Pluto, whose ex-wife taught me astrology. She was fantastic, is, and I
Wait,
learned from
which one? Which one?
Laurie Burnett, who co-wrote.
I know she was a student of mine for many years, actually. So I've heard many of Jeff Green's stories from her. Laurie's great.
Yes, we love her. And she was the first person who basically said, okay, here's where you start. Study Chiron. If you like Pluto, study Chiron. She sent me a copy, a tattered ancient copy of Esoteric Astrology,
Yes.
and taught me to look at progressed charts.
Well, yeah,
and
she was kind of working with me on my files and everything. She was staying at my house, actually, up in Sandpoint, Idaho, back in the late 90s and in 2000, 2001. She was, at that point, not involved with Jeff. Boy, could I ever tell Jeff Green stories, but we better not go there
We
right now.
could, couldn't we? But I mean, I have my own. I have my own, you know, good ones. But that I would not get sued for telling, because I was actually there when they happened. So okay, so Pluto is well, look, I mean, on one level, we're speculating when we talk about Pluto and Aquarius, and also everything is under the digital thrall right now. We're under a spell right now, I think.
Yes, I agree.
So part of the what happens with Pluto and Aquarius is, in some ways, the destiny of the spell itself. You know, because I think the spell has a lot to do with Shadow Aquarius. I mean, the idea that you could take an EMT who bravely entered what they were certain was the viral pandemic outbreak, whether or not it was, that's what they understood, and they worked around the clock in New York City from March through June, and then in 2021 got fired for not having a vaccine, an alleged vaccine. That's the darkest. There we are in concentration camp mentality at that point.
This is apparently true, that we're in Switzerland. You know, they have you can sign up to be euthanized, sort of like Soylent Green.
Oh, Canada's doing that too, even children.
Yeah, but here's the part of it that just shows just what a clown world it is and what a programming it is. In order to be able to be accepted into the to the assisted dying in Switzerland, you have to be injected first. I'm not making this.
I wish you were. It would be really funny. It's still pretty funny, but it would be brilliant if it weren't true and you were just making it up.
Jeez. I know. And since you follow all this stuff, you know, and a lot, they're now basically saying the people that are dying suddenly are because of all the disinformation and the fear that comes from it. So we're responsible for their deaths.
Yeah.
It's just nuts.
Well, this is out of the book of old tropes. I mean, they're always blaming the people who wanted to solve the problem for the problem.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm kind of thinking that we're definitely at a watershed moment in March of some kind, that there's some kind of a shakeup brewing between Saturn changing signs, Pluto changing signs, and Mars changing signs after this somewhat rare, strange... Yeah, 7 months Gemini, 3 hooks around Neptune...
Activating the Neptune Mars configuration on the U.S. chart, which was kind of lost in the kind of, for many people, it was lost in the fog of everybody putting their attention on Pluto and Pluto return. The Neptune opposition was, I think, equally important.
Yeah, so remind me the Neptune pattern. There's Neptune square, Mars square Neptune in the U.S. chart. There's this kind of kamikaze aspect in the U.S. chart.
Well, I'm using the Rajarian rectification of the 1776 July 4th chart, which I think works really incredibly well. Because the other thing happening in March is Saturn conjunct the U.S. Moon, you know, which is kind of bringing a lot of the stuff to what we're talking about here to a head. Saturn conjunct the Moon, and I also think Saturn into Pisces. If I could give you a quick take on that, is that Saturn into Pisces happening around the same time as Pluto into Aquarius? Saturn, from that perspective of the hijack that I was referring to, not real Saturn, but the more recent Saturn, is going to actually try to prevent Pisces from feeling and grieving and being able to be open their heart to that loving and grieving thing we've talked about, which I think is what Pluto is trying to do to Aquarius, if we use cause and effect language there, which I try not to do. From a shadow side, pardon me, from a dark side, Saturn is going to try to prevent Pisces from being compassionate and feeling and caring and humanitarian and empathic and so on. While Pluto to Aquarius is trying to get Aquarius to feel.
Mm-hmm.
And so that those two forces will come to a head. But I don't think, based on the way things are unfolding, that it will be successful. That something will happen to create more and more people to be forced to experience their grief.
Okay. I will leave that simmering on the hob. Here's in my inner space project, here's how I'm interpreting Saturn going into Pisces.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
So we've been living with Neptune in Pisces for quite a while, basically since 2012 era. And this has created a massive distortion of reality. It is bringing out all the D words associated with Neptune, but one of those D words is disappears. And so it's this invisible influence. I think Barbara Han Clow recently jokingly called it the elephant in the room, which I've been thinking for a long time, that it's kind of running the table in a way, but no one's looking at it and forget to mention it and talk about it. And Chiron left town and moved into Aries in 2018. And so we're left with this overwhelming presence of Neptune, like exponentially magnifying the denial, deception, delusion, drink, drugs, isolation qualities. And Saturn is entering, and that's going to start to set a boundary on that. It's going to start to clean up the edge. And Saturn pursues Neptune until they both land in Aries.
Right.
So I think we need some realism. I think that, and I'm not the only one to say this, that we're not living in a world of masculine energy run out of control. We're living in a world of yin energy that's gone completely out of control. It's the feminine energy that's not controlling and containing itself, and not interrelating. And even in relationships with men and women, I see a lot of men really wanting to be good people and get along with women. And there's a lot of programming to not do that. So I think that the Saturn in this feminine principle of Saturn entering Pisces is going to help set some ego boundaries around, like good, healthy ego boundaries around the out of control quality of Neptune in Pisces, resulting in this complete immersion in fantasy that we're living in.
Well, I would agree with your assessment if we looked at the larger story of Saturn. You know, back I was giving my assessment of it based upon the hijack of Saturn and the way what Saturn is going to try to do to prevent. Mm-hmm. The kind of thing you're describing with Pisces. So I like your take. That gives me a slightly different way of perceiving what is a positive and potential outcome, because I think we both agree that Saturn and Pluto are originally more toward the feminine side of the tree of life. But as far as what you said about women's role in all of this, I completely agree. The way I would describe it, though, is that they have become more, quote, patriarchal than men.
Uh-huh.
And in my own sphere, that's been my experience, that men mainly have been wanting to open their hearts and go deeper and to be more collaborative and to try to figure out what's gone wrong. And that women are the ones that tend to be, obviously I'm speaking generally here, it's not everybody, but tend to be the most strident. We even had a situation in our own school where this woman started taking too much control and she was saying stuff like the world would be way better off if 90% of the men were all killed, you know, and it basically caused a big uproar in our school and had to go through kind of a major kind of revolution, getting all new people and getting a different vision. It was about to be hijacked by that version of radical femininity, which is actually, in a sense, patriarchy on steroids.
Yeah.
And they're not even willing to look at how they have benefited by their subservience to, quote, patriarchal structures.
Mm. Mm. Nor to look at the, yes, thing one. And I'm... astonished that there's not that I know of a single sentence in all the feminist literature that I've read over the years that ever once thanks the many men who risked mm-hmm. their neck to help women have privileges in society, right. like getting their book published.
Right.
It's men are only bad, and you know that it's a propaganda campaign when mm-hmm. there's only one side of the story told, and where the definition of feminism is that men are rapists. Done.
Yeah.
That's all we need to know. It's like that doesn't sound complete. There seems to be something missing from the picture here. I know a bus driver. he gets up at 3 in the morning and drives the bus.
Right. I'm with you. At least I go back to the early 70s when it wasn't quite that way. The bringing, I was actually one of the individuals back at that time that was bringing the feminine into mainstream astrology, you know, which is, and it was a very important thing that was happening. And a lot of people don't know that it was to what extent Robert Bly, before he became known as this, guru for men,
mm-hmm.
as it were. He was the first one who brought Toni Wolff's imagery that came from her time with Jung into the community, and it actually became foundational. He was into the bringing the feminine in way before he got into men's work.
Mm-hmm. And his men's work is a lot about balance and mm-hmm. Making room in men for the feminine, and it, in many ways it seems to have succeeded. Pretty
yeah.
well.
I mean,
one of the most astounding things to me about 2017 was the year began on the 20th with Trump getting inaugurated. On the 21st was the Women's March in Washington, and I have audio recorded of the women chanting "My body, my choice," and then the guys all cheer "Her body, her choice." This is some of the most inspiring stuff I've ever heard in my entire life. Certainly at a protest.
Yes.
These women's voices answered by these men's voices. And to me, I read absolute sincerity in that. And then by October, we were back to all men are rapists, which I think is the product of a public relations firm. That's not really where society was going.
The same thing with the transgender thing, too. It's all public relations. It's not grassroots at all.
So here's an Aquarius. Here's a perfect shadow Aquarius. Thing is public relations injecting concepts that then kind of crystallize like Ice Nine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Just
I know
one molecule in the ocean, and that's it. We're living on Pluto. So
I got to look up Marshall McLuhan's horoscope information at some point here.
There's no time known. I would be thrilled to participate in a rectification, and we maybe even be able to get Larry Eli to help us, and Ursula Fugger might help us too. Two fantastic rectifiers, because I've checked with his son and grandson, and the time is not known. So can I run another idea of Pluto past you?
Sure, please.
All right, so Pluto was discovered and thought to be one thing, one planet in space, and it was largely ignored by astrology till the 60s. When Rudyard starts writing, I think, really, he's the one. And Crowley was writing about it in the Book of Thoth, so he was an early adapter. There was one book in Germany. And then Isabel Hickey puts out a pamphlet right before she dies, and right before the discovery of Charon, the binary of Pluto, saying this thing is a binary influence. There's a wisdom principle to Pluto. And she puts out this pamphlet. I've got a copy of the original. She departs us. And suddenly it's discovered that Pluto is a binary. It does have this planetary counterpoint. But now we know that there's six points orbiting a barycenter. Not Pluto's not the planet and Charon's not the moon. They're orbiting a common, all six points orbit a common barycenter.
Okay.
And I think this is a very different Pluto than the one that we read about, you know, in the more New Agey astrology books. And certainly in the Howard Sisportis book should come with a free razor blade version. in case you feel like cutting your wrists after any particular chapter, that Pluto is this magnificently beautiful thing out there. 6 points orbiting a common barycenter? This is no ordinary thing, no ordinary planet.
Well, actually, Rajar wrote, it wasn't just the 60s. That was just because his book came out, the paperback version came out in the 60s. But he wrote about Pluto back in the 30s and 40s.
Ah, okay. I've never seen a word of this.
Oh, yeah.
So what was he saying at that time? Like, what was, do you know his first take on Pluto?
Pretty much how I've described it. That it is actually from reading his material. And even his understanding of the underworld dimension, that's where I got the inspiration for using composting about it. I can send you some of that stuff if you'd like. I mean, I have a huge file on Rajar's material. But I have a long history with Pluto also because when Pluto perihelion was happening, I was in my Pluto square. I was when I was about 41, and I went through a whole stage where I actually was called a quote Pluto Pollyanna, because I would always go into this. Oh, you have a magnificent sort of New Age ridiculousness. You have a tremendous opportunity for transformation. You know, blah blah blah, blah. And I had to finally learn that no, that it really is about being a willingness to surrender and to go into a place where you can't figure anything out. You know, there is a dark night of the soul element of it for sure. And can you imagine what the dark night of the soul is going to be for the Aquarian thing we've talked about? I mean, it may take a micronova to wipe out the satellites. I mean, it's, you know, in order to take down the cage, you know, cage that is being put around the natural Earth.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I haven't studied the Sputnik chart, but that's kind of where it begins.
It was that same time period. I'll just tell you an interesting story is that when I was growing up, when I was 8, 9, 10 years old, I was hugely idealistic about the space program. I was caught up in the huge idealism about it. But I came upon some documents right after Kennedy's assassination. I was 15 when that happened, and which basically was exposing that it was all a cover for the military. And so by the time the whole moon thing happened in 1969, it's just I didn't even care about it anymore because I knew the whole thing was a cover for military.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that sort of broken heart thing that came from that was just another, you know, stifling of the potential idealism with Aquarius, you know, that was happening during those years. The killing of the three kings, you know, was really just shut a lot of it down, unfortunately. I have a lot of grief about it, actually.
You mean Martin Luther and JFK and RFK?
Yeah, the three kings, yeah. The ritual sacrifice of the three kings.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. I'm with you on the space program thing. I finally concluded it didn't matter whether the moon landing happened because the whole thing was a cover up for the ICBM.
Yeah. Totally.
And you couldn't sell that to the public. But you could certainly sell Neil Armstrong.
Mm-hmm.
Who doesn't love Neil Armstrong? For me, that's the right. But I mean, really, the Eagle Scout. To me, this is the great, you know, the great tragedy of it is that, you know, ideals for sale. They're just going to sell us our ideals right back to us.
Right.
So I get the drift here about Pluto burning off some of all of that kind of waste gas, idealistic waste gas, and getting down to more of the essence of what it means to cooperate and to confront the human experience together, which is what Aquarius really, I think, could be.
Could be. Yes. 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 I would agree with that. But it's, if it leaves out the higher side or the idealistic side of Leo, which is sovereignty and autonomy, then it just becomes what we've been talking about all along. You know, it becomes the Borg.
Right. So it's very important to integrate the opposite sign. I mean, this is, Alice Bailey 101. Very, nobody else really talks about this besides her, to think of the sign pairs as a single system.
Well, I don't know if that... I came into that big time in the 70s, and pretty much every astrologer was looking at it that way then.
Where were they getting it from?
From Zipporah Dobbins, I guess. Rajar, definitely. I mean, you look at them both. I mean, even some of the more remarkable writing he did in the 60s, even before that book came out. Where else did I get it from? Tony Joseph, from a lot of the greatest male astrologers who turned out were all gay and that ended up dying of AIDS. Tony Joseph being the incredibly amazing. Unfortunately, his book called The Remythologizing of Astrology, he didn't finish it before because he died of AIDS. I was near his, I was with him pretty much right before he died.
Right. Was he on AZT?
Yeah, of course.
Right. So he died of AZT.
Right. And the other also, same thing with Howard Sisportis, but also the Richard Eidman.
Patrick Walker.
Who is it?
Patrick Walker.
Don't know about that one.
He was a horoscope writer. I mean, he was really the greatest of all horoscope writers. And Sisportis was writing his column when he was sick, and then Melanie. So Patrick Walker column was written by Sisportis when Patrick was sick, and when they were both sick, Melanie Reinhart wrote it.
I didn't know about that side of it at all. But Richard Eidman also was another one. It's really hilarious. During the 70s, I would go to astrology conferences, and it was just like now. It's like, you know, 70, 80, 90% of them were women. And so there were the conversations would be, this is incredible, all these male guys that we're following, and they're all gay, which was really kind of funny because, you know, there weren't any until Jeff came along, but that was all a different issue. The way he put down women was off the charts. I mean, just ridiculous. But my point being that there was a huge injection of the aspects of great feminine that came in the 70s, and it was from men.
From men, right.
Yes.
Right, taking the leadership. It's like the joke in The Onion. The feminist movement appoints a male CEO, and it, like, rescues the movement. This is what an Onion cover from years ago. You know, flagging feminist movement, you know, brought back by male CEO. I'll find
right.
it for you.
No, I didn't
it's
know
just,
about that.
It's just, it's yeah, just brilliant. It's brilliant.
It's just like how many of these women are so involved in the development of the Borg in big tech.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so here we go. We're going in to Pluto and Aquarius. No turning back. This is a 20-year transit. Interesting, Pluto makes 3 ingresses into Aquarius, as opposed to the usual 2 for as long as we've been alive.
Right.
And we're entering the era of the Pluto square happening after the Chiron return. The people born now are going to start having their Pluto squares around age 60, right?
Right.
Whereas prior to the Uranian opposition.
If you were born in 1900, it happened at age 65. If you were born at 1800, it happened at age 89.
Pluto's right, because Pluto takes like 30 years to go through Taurus, right?
And Cancer.
Right. So all those Taurus, Gemini, Cancer, it's 90 years in those 3 signs.
Yeah.
So the nature of Pluto is changing, you know, as we are experiencing it. But what I hear you saying is it's going to, at its best, make us into deeper people in Aquarius.
Well, I think it increases the bifurcation, you know, which is the main symbol I read on the U.S. chart. I mean, one of three, but, you know, one of the main three, the bifurcation is right in there with Neptune, square Mars, and Gemini. But what I mean by this is people will choose to go into the Borg, or they will, one way or the other, do what's necessary to remain human 1.0. And I think that Pluto being... you know, an instinctual and organic, if I could put it that way, energy. I mean, it doesn't care about humans so much, but it is concerned about life and not the life in silicon, but, you know, actual life, mm-hmm. Water, you know, water-based crystals and so on, it will do whatever is necessary to maintain Earth 1.0, if I could put it that way, you know, so... bring it on, you know. I mean, I just hope it won't require that the most astounding amount of suffering in order to open the hearts.
Yeah, and in even that, it does not seem to be a thing that succeeds so well. Usually, I mean, 9/11 was a Pluto event. It was Pluto's opposite Saturn, and it. Saturn and Gemini, twin towers, Pluto in Aquarius, drop them like marionettes. Mm-hmm. And yet that does not seem to have been hard opening. That was co-opted pretty much before it even began.
Indeed.
And that was when we were supposed to also be masked and duct tape your windows, don't trust the mail. So
I
don't know. I'm glad I'm human. I feel the brain damage of digital exposure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the alienation from nature. I mean, part of it is I just have to work so much to get done these two major things I do. But I feel it when I handle my musical instruments. My yes. musical instruments have become alien to me in the past few years. Mm. And I consider it really a form of brain damage that I have to recover from, that I have to heal from, and to, you know, reconnect with those parts of my consciousness that, you know, have been excluded by essentially being on the front lines of this world information war.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for me, it's I haven't I was a world traveler, but ever since this thing started in early 2020, I took the last possible flight I could get on. I was ready to do all kinds of in-person events. I'm in Arizona in early 2020. I was in the U.S. in 2020 then in March. And at middle of the night, I found out there's the last possible flight I could get on to get back home. And I haven't traveled at all since, because Philippines is one of the countries that even Philippine citizens, if you leave the country, you can't come back in the country without your injections and boosters.
Right.
You know, it's still kind of like the U.S. in a weird way, where, I mean, I could fly to the U.S. Because I have a U.S. passport, but nobody else can get into the United States unless you have a U.S. passport without the boosters and injections.
Mm-hmm.
My wife couldn't travel with me. It's almost impossible to get a visa from here to the U.S. unless you have a lot of extra money and to pay off somebody.
I'm grieving that I may never leave the United States again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But go ahead, please.
Go ahead.
I mean, when the COVID shit started, I purchased a framed topographical map of New York State.
Mm-hmm.
And I hung it on the wall of the room where I usually work as a reminder that if I'm stuck in New York State the rest of my life, it's not the worst place to be.
Mm-hmm.
Got real mountains, got real oceans, and lakes, and forests, and cities, and rural.
Well, there's apparently that whole, isn't that true? I mean, you know, you're there, you'll know more about this, but I've heard that a lot of these... The sort of the train people have their farms and communities up in the Hudson River Valley.
Well, it is true that New York was kind of a seat of the original resistance movement. We've got Andrew Kaufman here. We've got Tom Cowan here. A bunch of anthroposophics are here. I'm here. Will Houston is here. So it has definitely been a hotbed of cross-pollination. I mean, even just within a 60-70 mile radius of where I'm sitting, it's broken down a lot. You know, the movement is changing, quote unquote, is changing very fast, and now it's become a kind of a cult-like cartel. So there's not much in the way of grassroots that I am aware of. And you know, I've been staying in a lot to get my stuff done. Because I'm here to serve, and I'm called to service. So what's that
situation too? The whole flat Earth thing about, you were telling me in the emails that how that the number of the terrain people are like rabid flat earthers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I did send out the memo explaining that it is a CIA PSYOP hotbed, and that you know, you're standing in a trap. And why don't we, let's just stick to the issue. And look, guys, I'm not one to talk. I'm an astrologer. Mm-hmm. But I do openly say that astrology has got nothing to do with science. It's a branch of ethics. Yeah. So I'm not, you know, I'm not preaching any scientific validity of astrology. I'm tea leaf reading, I promise you.
Right.
I'm hugging trees, and I'm listening to gophers, and they happen to be planetary. Mm-hmm. There you go. Shut up.
Well, we have the same page there. I mean, I'm definitely using the version of astrology that was to the leading edge in the early 70s, which is not non-deterministic. You know, it was actually morals, ethics, and a way of fulfilling and actualizing life purpose.
Yeah, I feel like I should offer a recovery project for medieval, you know, and I have. I mean, anybody who comes to me and says they were damaged by medieval astrology, I will just work for it for free.
I can add some other names to that of the people I've had to help. The damage of the going to a Vedic session and says you have a 19-year Saturn cycle, and then they're just damaged by that, you know. And or the, you know, certain astrologers that I won't name that I have to help people that have been damaged by what they experienced from them. You know, we could probably collaborate on that, couldn't we, Eric?
Well, yeah, and you know, even since the beginning, when I was working for the Jackie Stallone Psychic Circle, and someone, you know, the phone rang, you know, I was on the carousel, and the young woman said, you know, the last person on this hotline told me that I was pregnant with a space alien's baby.
Right.
So I went into like sex educator mode. I'm like, well, are you pregnant? Oh, I don't think so. Have you had unprotected sex lately? No. Okay, have you had any alien encounters lately? Anything weird going on? A little missing time or anything like that? No. Any beams of blue light? No. Okay, well, I don't know. I'm looking at this tarot spread, and it kind of says nothing's wrong. If that's okay with you. Okay? So I just took, like, the straight-up, plain Jane, good old-fashioned Gestalt therapy approach. What you got going on?
Yep.
What's up? How are you feeling?
Yeah, the actual what you're bringing up here is also one of the biggest topics in our school. To me, astrology is a heart-to-heart encounter. That the moment that you are with another person and sharing it, then magic can happen, and that's when the transmission happens.
Yeah.
The problem is when it becomes digital reports, or if it becomes something that makes it look like a cookbook. You know, this is always going to mean this, or this is always going to mean that. Then you're taking it away from what astrology really is, which is actually, like Jeffrey Cornelius, you know, talks about it as, you know, it's just a It's divination. It just happens to be the most comprehensive yeah. of any divination system that anybody's mm-hmm. ever thought of,
mm-hmm.
and which is what I explore in my second book, The Origins of the Paradigm, which is looking at how it compares with other divination systems.
Mm-hmm. Well, I read an ever-increasing number of planets, because I work with the Centaurs and the TNOs, and especially the trans-Neptunian objects. There's interesting ones that come along that really are quite amazing. I mean, I've got enough to work with Varuna and Quasar. I mean, some fabulous things, percolated out in the late 90s, and QB1, the first one ever, 1992 QB1. So I'm not adding things so fast, but I can work with any number of about 100 different points. So you add that, and then it becomes mind-boggling to old school people.
Yeah, I had to make a decision on that some time ago, and I was influenced to a certain extent by some of Robert Hand's work before he got totally into medieval, which is that since in our school we use wide orbs, not small orbs.
Mm-hmm.
And so the proposition that I've dealt with is, what is the actual number of objects to use on a chart, where if you go beyond that certain number, you can prove anything you want by anything?
I hear you. But I work with aspect patterns. I'm not quite worried about proving anything. I'm interested in the way that the pattern forms among a diversity of points. And then I work with different patterns in different layers and just kind of move through them real quickly, sometimes not even needing to say very much at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Listen, if you want someone to teach the class on how to handle new planets, mm-hmm. I would be thrilled to do that, because I've been teaching it for 25, 30 years, and mm-hmm. Philosophizing on it and working it pretty much every day. And I mean, I love reading a 7-point chart also. Like, if I'm doing horary and I really need to know if I know what I'm talking about, I just take out everything and just look at mm-hmm. Moon through Saturn and tell the story.
Well, I'm not saying it should be 7. I mean, basically, the proposition is, to me, it's somewhere between, certainly beyond 7. But using the 10-degree orb and the particular techniques I use, and I'm not in any way being critical of other people's work. I mean, just it's within the framework of what I'm seeing, is that I can extend it to maybe I don't know what the magic number is. It could be as much as 22. I usually use about 13 or 14 at this particular time period. So I use Chiron, I use Pluto. I will sometimes use the big four asteroids, but I've tended to incorporate those into the signs and the planets by bringing all the different stories into the signs and the planets, making all the signs and planets both masculine and feminine, mm-hmm. and then all the stories, from going back before the gender thing with romance language happened, like in Ireland, for example, in many of the northern European countries, there were gods and goddesses for both the sun and the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there was not a situation where, well, obviously the moon is feminine and the sun is masculine. Well, no, not really. I mean, it could be looked at the other way around. In mm-hmm. fact, the further you go back, that distinction is not even there.
Right.
Right.
And in horary, Venus can represent a man or a woman. Moon can represent a man or a woman.
Yeah.
It's all just staying internally consistent and intuitively open, I think.
One of the things that we could do, I mean, maybe not in this particular call, but... I have just as a future thing, if you wanted to ever rap about it, I do have a pretty long, I probably have 50 books of reading the biographies of different musicians and rock stars and so on, and incorporating it into astrology. And it's a real fun thing to go through. And I think you do that too.
Well, I will often do the astrology of my musical guests on the program to kind of add an educational and, you know, interest to it, and to speak about them spiritually in a respectful way.
Yeah.
Well, listen, it's been fabulous speaking with you. You know, thank you for sharing. I've heard about you for many, many years, and it's fabulous to get to speak with you tonight. And I think, you know, it seems to me we've got a couple of other things to talk about here beside the rising tide. So let me know when time, bandwidth, and willingness opens up. And you're always welcome on the program if you have something that you want to, as you say, rap about and flesh out a little bit and kind of put them into the particle collider and see what new elements we create.
That's great. I've been wanting to have this kind of conversation with you for a very long time also. And there are too many of us that go into it the way we are right now. So, and it's great to have another person out there that I can, share about it with. I would love to have a further conversation with you. So thank you very much for inviting me.
My pleasure. Daniel G. Mario, world traveling American astrologer, now in the Philippines. I hope I get to meet you someday.
The Turning of the Ages Mystery School is my school.
Got it. We'll link to that. Turning of the Ages Mystery School. And I'll link to your book. And again, thank you.
Thanks a lot. Okay, bye.
Bless. Bye for now.